Welcome to Hotter Than Ever, where we uncover the unconscious rules we've been following, we break those rules, and we find a new path to being freer, happier, sexier, and more self-expressed. I'm your host, Erin Keating. Today, I talk to graphic designer and author Elizabeth Chai about how she has bought essentially nothing for the past 5 years. I did not think that that was possible. She's laid out a whole plan for how you can invent your own program to do the same thing and renegotiate your relationship with consumerism and spending. We talk about how your stuff helps to broadcast your identity and how easy it is to spend money unconsciously. I know I do it all the time. We talk about what minimalism really means, and it doesn't mean living in an austere white box of a home or an apartment. We get into some deep stuff about how things looking perfect and projecting a certain image on the surface can be a smokescreen for the things you don't really want to look at underneath that might not be so pretty. This was a surprisingly deep conversation that has me cleaning out every single closet in my house. Take a listen. Elizabeth Chai is a graphic designer and coffee aficionado. She is also the author of the book, How to Buy Essentially Nothing for a Year, which we're going to talk about today. That sounds impossible, but Liz definitely did it. Welcome to Hotter Than Ever, Liz.
Thank you so much for having me. And yes, it's definitely possible. I'm actually in my fifth year of buying essentially nothing.
Oh my God. Oh, I need this. We all need this. We have not talked about materialism, consumerism, spending, buying, shopping. That is not a thing we've covered on the Hotter Than Ever podcast, but it is a part of all of our lives in late capitalist America.
And absolutely.
Yeah, I'm dying to hear sort of how you came to this experience and how it changed your life. And you spent the year 2020 not buying anything at all.
I didn't buy anything that I didn't absolutely need. So
okay.
That's why I have the word essentially in the title of my book, because right. I'm allowed to buy essentials. So
you're allowed to eat.
I'm allowed to eat. I let myself buy food. And then usually it's easier for people, I think, to understand when I explain like, oh, I can get toilet paper and toothpaste. And trying to think of other things that are like absolute essentials, food. I let myself get whatever food that I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And then pretty much nothing else, you know, unless I had it on a list of items that were absolutely necessary, I opted out of buying. And the whole thing started as a New Year's resolution.
Which famously fail for everyone, but not for you.
I do historically love structure and creating rules for myself. So I'm a very black and white thinker, and that's just probably a personality thing. But usually at the end of the year, I do a review of my year and how it went. And then I'd like to dream up different ideas for changes that I want to make, ways that I want to improve, things that I want to accomplish. I've kind of given that the name, the Dreamatorium. And I do that not just at the end of the year. I do like a little Dreamatorium session pretty regularly as I'm sort of vision casting for me, like in my career, I'm a graphic designer. So I brainstorm a lot.
I love it. I love your words too. Dreamatorium, vision casting. Okay, we're already in the land of woo. It's excellent. You were not always a person who was buying essentially nothing. You're a designer. You like beautiful things and objects. And yeah. I would love to rewind to the place where your life was most maximal so that we can kind of lead up to what led to this from a personal and emotional perspective, because I think that is so much a part of your story.
Absolutely. And I love that you're asking that, because I think when we first encountered each other, you maybe didn't even know about what went into the
That's
idea.
Right.
So yeah, I would say I was pretty average, you know, living like a standard Western or, you know, American lifestyle of buying stuff. And I had, at the time, I would say at the height of my excess, which again was probably pretty average.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in a freestanding modern loft in Atlanta with my then husband. I had my design studio. I mean, this loft was gorgeous. It was 3,000 square feet and two living rooms. I owned 8 couches at one time. I had, you know, a wardrobe full of clothes. I had so much. To me, it seems now like I had so much stuff. At the time, it didn't. It just felt average.
Just filled up the space.
It filled up the space.
Added flair and identity and personality to where you were living, and it signified a lot of stuff, right? Especially as a designer, your aesthetic choices are meaningful.
Yeah, I had to have so much of myself visually represented in the choices that I made as a buyer. So like the way I decorated my home, the way I dressed, I wanted it to portray my identity. I wanted it to show what good taste I had. Mm. I wanted it to show a very specific thing about me. I wasn't actively thinking like, this is what I want people to think about me. It was a very subconscious thing. And I think everyone does that.
Yes.
As we're growing up, I had to explore this a lot in myself as well, just as in grade school, you know, we're all trying to figure out what our identity is. And many of us, we develop that identity by the clothes we wear, the fashion, you know, the hair that we choose to have, and the even like the friend groups that we have. There's so much about that that's like we want to differentiate ourselves. There's this individualism that is a huge part of American and Western society, is we have to show how unique we are.
Right.
And I don't think all of that is necessarily a bad thing, but it can get us really hung up on the surface level stuff.
And yeah. As a Gen Xer, I found that sort of, I sort of found myself through my look in like eighth or ninth grade, right? Like, and I dyed my hair pink in the front, which nobody was doing. I shaved half of it off. I wore these weird clothes. I was a thrift store girl. And then all the cool people could see that I was a cool person.
Yeah.
And then we could find each other. And that those were the codes that we were using, was sort of
absolutely
demonstrating like, hey, I don't buy into this preppy bullshit. Like, you know, check out my granny boots. We could see each other on the street. I don't know that it's quite the same today. I don't think the codes are quite as clear, or maybe I'm just old.
I think it's a different kind of code that has been dreamed up. So, and I think that the younger generation, I'm Gen X as well. And, you know, also went through very similar codes, which is funny. I was a cheerleader in high school and in college, but then I started breaking those sort of like social rules about what athletics person should look like and who they should hang out with. And I got some flack for that in college, I would say, because I was hanging out with the theater kids and with at the radio station. I actually was the music director at my college radio station and started thrifting and wearing Chuck Taylors and the kind of stuff that people didn't really know how to meld those two, because there's this natural desire to put people in a box or to put them into a category, not be able to see that might be like it should have flexible or gray lines. Not everyone is just like, this one is thing. How a person is. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's all sort of part of that journey, I think, that we all take, is finding out who we are and then figuring out our values and what's important to us. And after I had gone through many seasons of trying to create my own identity through stuff, I think we all do it. I lost everything. And I went through a very difficult divorce from a verbally and psychologically abusive spouse who had an alcohol problem. And I had to, well, truly it was the best thing that could happen, because I would have never have said that at the time.
Sure.
But it was the thing that woke me up, and it was the thing that helped me learn how to let go of and release all of that stuff I had placed too much focus on what things looked like on the outside. And I started paying attention to what is actually important. And it's not 8 sofas. It's not me having the right clothes to portray my style to the world. It's like, what do I actually care about in life? And, you know, it's such a trope, I guess, but you can't take it with you. And I realized, like, I don't want to spend my whole life putting all this work into building up this a sandcastle that's eventually going to get knocked down. Mm. So, you know, I want to live a vibrant life and I want to live it in a good way. And you don't find fulfillment in material things. So yeah, that's
it's so hard to believe that though,
mm-hmm.
when we swim in the waters of consumerism and everything around us is telling us, you know, buy this and you will feel this.
Yep.
Like yeah. buy this and you will improve this part of your life, or, you know, you will show up as someone who belongs. When you and I were talking before this call, we had a conversation about an object that I owned that conferred all kinds of meaning and identity on me that I wasn't sure that I wanted, which was an engagement ring.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, an engagement ring is such like a loaded object. And once I had that thing on my finger, people looked at me, women looked at me a different way and had a different kind of conversation with me and sort of welcomed me into a society of married people and conventional life in a way that I never felt a part of. And that I still, even wearing the ring, I was like, the fuck is this? Like, I don't think I want this. And the ring was very pretty, but had I been more conscious of even the codes that I was buying into, I would have had a very different kind of ring or no ring at all.
Right,
because I didn't want to be in that club with those women. I didn't feel like, I was like, okay, now I can fake my way in this club I don't really even want to be in. But it helped me in my professional life in a weird way because people were like, one of us, one of
Well, but you probably didn't even realize that club existed until you were wearing that ring and noticed the way people treated you.
That's right. That's
right. But having it ripped out of your hands, and then when you no longer have it, you have to learn how to accept not being in that club anymore. At least I have had to do that with stuff. There are a lot of people who I think don't really want to talk to me about my project because it in a way it feels threatening. Mm. It's like the idea of not buying stuff is scary to people who aren't ready to release the attachments that they place on stuff. And this is even just in conversations with friends over the years where they're like, no, I'm good with this thing that I love. I love this thing. I have this. This is my lifestyle. And just leave it at that without exploring more in depth about why are you placing this value on the lifestyle? Why do you need to be in that club?
Right. And to be totally clear, like, you have stuff all around you.
Mm-hmm.
You are not a person who is living in a white box.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I always think like minimalism, well, that means you don't have anything. You know, it's just like a white box with a vase and one flower. But the fact is that your aesthetic is vintage and funky and really cool. And like, you still use things as a marker for yourself. Mm-hmm. Because you're a designer and that gives you pleasure and joy, apparently. Mm-hmm. Like it seems to. I'm making an assumption.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what minimalism actually is, because it isn't not having anything.
Correct. And that is absolutely another, I guess, a misnomer. People just automatically think, oh, if I do what you're doing, then I'm going to have to live in a white box. I'm not going to be able to enjoy my stuff. And that's absolutely not true. Everything that I talk about in my book is about customization for your own values, the things that are important to you. So me as a graphic designer, I do need to surround myself with visual inspiration. And, you know, over the years, I have collected so many things. And also, I have lost many things. I have gotten rid of many things and learned different ways of operating so that I'm surrounded by the visual inspiration that I need. But now I'm able to do it without buying stuff. And
what is that? What do you mean? Well, you have stuff, but you don't buy it. Please explain.
Correct. Well, yeah. So let's back up just a tiny bit.
Yes.
So I decided that I wasn't going to buy material things that I didn't need. And that meant I had to establish what a need was and what was important for me. And that's basically the first step in doing a project like this. You need to understand your why. You need to understand what it is you're trying to accomplish. And for me, one of the very first things at the top of my list of my values and my goals for that year was to appreciate and have gratitude for the things that I already have without needing to obtain more. Mm. So I kept buying stuff even though I was surrounded by beautiful things already. And that was the thing that sort of made me pause and ask, why do I keep buying stuff when I already have so much? Why do I feel like I need to keep getting more and more? And what if just for a year, I allowed myself to appreciate the things I was already surrounded with without a more craving? You know, it's like Thanksgiving dinner. Why do we continue to eat more until we're so stuffed that we have a stomach ache? That's sort of how I felt when I made that decision, was like, I'm in that stomach ache. I have too much stuff, but I'm still consuming.
Why do you think you were still consuming?
I think some of it is just, it was habitual. Mm-hmm. It was small things. Like if I was grocery shopping, I'd walk through the makeup aisle and be like, ooh, another red lipstick. Mm. Even though at home I have 10 different red lipsticks that are all basically the same red. Mm-hmm. So I only wear one color.
Like the one red.
Right. And it was very thoughtless, mindless consuming. Or I'd be like, ooh, I want to go to the vintage store and see, you know, what treasures I can find, like what vintage dress is there that I don't even know it exists, but I want to go find it and be delighted by it and then buy it. And it's, you know, maybe only 20 or 30 bucks, not that much money, but
no harm really.
Well, that's the thing, is it's still excess, whether it's a $20 purchase or a $2,000 purchase, because I didn't need it.
Because you had closets full of beautiful vintage
dresses. I had a whole closet. Exactly. There's no reason why I should need another dress when I already have more than 100.
Right. Right. And if you wanted different stuff, mm-hmm. there's all of these like buy nothing lists and
right.
sort of, you know, swaps and things that people do now that are mm-hmm. sort of, I always think of it as like environmentally focused, mm-hmm. which is like wanting to reduce your carbon footprint or your impact on the planet, but it's also money saving. You know, right. I did a lot of that stuff when my twins were really young mm-hmm. because I was like, I am only going to use this thing
right.
for this period of time. Mm-hmm. Like, how can I get a cheap or free version of this thing? And so, yeah, I lived in Brooklyn at the time and I was always sort of going to people's apartments and grabbing their thing and giving them a thing. And we were, mm-hmm. because we were living in small spaces, we right. were trying to manage the stuff of everything. Mm-hmm. But I always love the idea of a clothing swap, but mm-hmm. I'm like 5'10 and a size 14. So I always fail. It's always just like misery for me. So yeah. I'm like, everything's so cute and tiny. I can't have it.
Well, I mean, I guess let's swing back around to how I'm obtaining things now. So
yeah.
Buy nothing is something I'm very active in. And for, like I said, I'm in my fifth year now. So I was doing clothing swaps. It was just kind of like my friend group was like, let's do a clothing swap. It'd be fun. And a variety of different sizes and styles, but it was still kind of fun to bring your excess
yeah.
and then find a couple of items. And usually if I had leftovers after a clothing swap, I would donate them. What else? Because I realized more recently, just like it's very easy for me to get new clothes. So I'll maybe take dresses that I already have, take them to the consignment shop and then get store credit and mm-hmm. then I can get new stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that I've been doing for a number of years. And then I realized I had to do like a gut check with myself and realize I'm not actually accomplishing my original goal to appreciate and have gratitude for the things that I already have. So one of my new goals for this year is, I guess it's more of a value. It's that I have enough. I have enough dresses. I don't need. So this year I'm not allowing myself to get even free clothes. Even in my Buy Nothing group, I'm not allowed to do clothes just for this year, and we'll see how it goes.
How does that next feel? Year.
There have been a couple moments where I have seen something hanging on a rack. So I do. There's a couple of consignment stores where I go and I take stuff to sell. And now I'm not letting myself walk through the clothing section or even like look at it. But I saw something in there. I saw a woman carrying a beautiful vintage dress and I was like, oh, you know, it hurts for a second. That was like, you know, maybe a few weeks ago. And, you know, I had to allow myself to feel that like pain of like, I can't get that even if I want it. But now it's kind of like, it's just a dress, you know, it was a really great dress, but it's fine. It's just a dress. I have a lot of great dresses and then it, let it go.
And you said in your first year, you let yourself buy food, you could have coffee, and if you wanted something, you would put it on a list.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that practice?
Absolutely. So actually, the dress I'm wearing right now, I bought it with a gift card. So I was given like $100, like a Visa gift card. And to me now, that's like gold. So it's like when I have this $100 I can spend, I'm going to be very, very, very thoughtful about what it is I'm going to spend that on. And I'm so in the coffee industry, I attend conventions and usually every year it's kind of like a family reunion. So we see people that we haven't seen for a year.
Nice.
And I always love to wear a different, you know, I don't want to repeat my dresses. So I knew that I was going to save that gift card for buying the dresses that I'd be wearing to convention that year. And I was hung on tight to it. And then I was like very thoughtful in how I decided what I was going to get with that gift card. So I was able to buy two or maybe three dresses that I wore to convention. So I wore this dress to the coffee convention. But that's the kind of thing where it's like I will put things on a wish list if it's, I think, 1 year ahead, like an Instapot. I really wanted the Instapot. I know they're kind of trendy. Maybe they're trending out now, but I was like, I really want the Instapot, but
certainly
can't
during
buy
COVID,
it.
Yeah.
So I put it on like it's my birthday / Christmas list because my mom is always going to ask me, you know, what do you want for your birthday or for Christmas? And so I saved it up like all year long. I'm like, it's going to be the Instapot's what I'm going to ask my mom for. And she got me one.
Yeah.
One.
It sounds so simplifying.
Yeah.
What you're doing.
Delayed gratification.
Well, I just explained the term delayed gratification to my 13-year-old son. Mm-hmm. And he was like, what are you talking about? Because I just got my kids their first debit cards. Mm. And I gave them money for their 13th birthday. And my daughter has all of her money and then some because she's been saving. And my son's is almost gone. And so what I wanted for them was this experience of managing their impulses, their desires, and their materialism, because I've noticed that they want things all the time and they use things, especially because they're 13 and they can't drive and they have no agency. Mm-hmm. Like things become a sort of central part of their lives. And I recognize that they are starting to build patterns around this stuff. And, you know, every day boxes of shit show up from Amazon for me, for the house and for, you know, maintaining our lives and whatever we need. And they see kind of the fluidity of money. And then they hear me sometimes being like, well, you know, that's actually not a priority for us financially. Right. And then they get worried and nervous. Like there's all sorts of feelings and life experience that goes into this consumerism in my home. And I brought up to them while reading your book, this first exercise that was like your gateway exercise, which is the minimalism game.
Yeah.
And we agreed to play it in April.
Oh, great. I've been playing it with some friends this last month.
Can you explain to the listeners what that is?
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to give full credit to the minimalists because they're the ones who dreamed that up.
And they have a podcast.
They do. They have and books as well, which I recommend all the time because their memoir, Everything That Remains, has been so inspiring for me. And it's also a story of loss and adjusting your relationship with material things. So that was also my gateway. So a friend of mine told me about this game. You get rid of one thing on day one, you get rid of two things on day two, and then you do that for a month. So at the end of the month, it's something like 460 something items
that you've gotten rid of. Of course,
that you have gotten rid of, whether it's donate, give away, throw away, recycle, sell it, just get it out of your house.
Yeah.
And so I started playing that game. It was probably 2015, which is the year that I was about to move from Atlanta to Portland. And
which
so
is
it's
sort
really,
of the year after your marriage ended.
And exactly.
You sort of had to get reconciled with, like, I had all this stuff. Now I'm going to get rid of this stuff. What do I keep? What do I haul across the country with me?
Exactly. It's really easy to play that game when you're moving too, because you have to no one wants to move with every single thing they have in their house. Most people are getting rid of things as they move.
Yeah.
So I played that game. It sounded scary, but my friend just said it could be a paperclip. I'm like, okay, well, if it's little things, then why not play this game? So I started doing it, and I love a list. I love a checklist and feeling accomplished.
Yeah.
So I played the game, and you know, I've been playing it ever since. And so I don't really do now. At this month in particular, I'm doing it with a few friends for Lent. So we're going for 40 days, and I can't remember. We're like 2/3 of the way through right now. So it's getting difficult. So I think today I have to get rid of 22 things, maybe.
Oh my gosh.
It's fine, because you are your brain shifts into this mode of, like, you identify a thing, you're like, is this a thing I can get rid of? So an expired coupon. And like, I sold a twin bed frame on Craigslist yesterday. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. A paperclip is one thing. A bed is one thing. But by the end of the month, if you're doing it for a month, then it's 460 something items. And it feels great, because you won't remember anything that you got rid of. Mm. It was in your house and it was meaningless. It was something you were hanging on to that you didn't need or want enough that you could let it go. And you'll probably never think about it again.
And is this kind of akin to the Marie Kondo, like, get rid of it if it doesn't spark joy?
I guess so. I feel like everyone should decide for themselves, what does excess mean for you? Mm. Like, because I'm an artist, I have an appreciation for having beautiful things in the home, even if they don't have a function necessarily. So that's something that's important to me that might not be important for other people.
Right.
So the sparking joy, I think it's a great idea to inspire people to think about, like, whether they want to get rid of things. With Marie Kondo's book, when I read it, I thought it was fantastic until I realized it was more organizational. Mm-hmm. So it's really helpful to organize what you have. But then I might be organizing, say, my sock drawer, and then still hanging on to the socks that I don't need. You know,
right.
Like, I try to just keep enough socks and undergarments to last me a month. So in theory, I can do laundry once a month.
Right. And like, what socks really spark joy? It's like,
well,
you
exactly.
have to have it. But I hate half my socks. I mean, I hate half my t-shirts. I hate half the stuff in my closet. And, you know, my kids know that I like nothing better than to go into their closet, throw everything out, empty the closet completely, throw it onto a pile on the floor and in the middle of the room, and just hold things up and make them make choices. Because then they're so much happier in their living space, and they only have what they need. It's much easier for me to do that for them than it is for me to do for me and the whole house and the garage and all of it, you know?
Yeah. Another one is books. Like, I have some friends who are scholars, and they might not necessarily be reading and rereading certain books, but they do like to have them for reference. I don't hold that against anyone. Like, you really have to choose what makes sense for your life. I've chosen to hang on to some of my favorite, like, most of them are children's books or novels that I've loved. And I'm like, I do want to reread this on paper someday. So I've used the idea of getting rid of things to pare down and to really hone in on, like, I can release some of these things, but I'm going to hang on to some of this stuff as part of my personal collection. And I am doing that with CDs, doing that with vinyl. All the most people have, you know, DVDs or whatever. I don't know what
old media that doesn't really function in our lives very much anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. I read a lot of business and personal development books, and some of those I've hung on to for many years, but a lot of those it's like, okay, I read it the one time and that's enough, and I can pass it along to someone else, put it in a little free library, or, you know, donate it, and then someone else can learn from it as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So you think the whole idea of retail therapy, it's such a thing that we're sold as like, well, go buy something that'll make you feel good. Do you think that's just totally bullshit?
I think there's always going to be potential harm in it if you're using that justification to avoid pain. Mm. I don't think it's all bad necessarily. Like, it can be fun to go out with your friends and do a shopping day, or even if it's not involved, even if shopping is not involved, to have like a self-care day, you know, the treat yourself day. Mm-hmm. I don't hate that. But if you are using it in a way to run away from something, then it's maybe not the best choice. You know, some people go overboard on that. And it's really easy, I think, to get hooked on when you're having a bad day, buy something new. We have all done it, and no judgment at all. Like, I have done that. And now that I don't have that as an option, it's pretty natural for me to find other things that I can do to feel better, you know, rather than maybe I should sit with my feelings.
Right. Who wants to do that? Right. Yeah. I find that anytime I think, oh, I'm going to have a shopping day and it's going to be so fun. And I tend to do that kind of stuff by myself, which is the first mistake, because really what I'm craving is connection.
Yeah.
And what, you know, it's what I'm always craving, and what I, then I go and I don't find what I want, and I have this like existential despair at the mall. And I wonder how many other people are having that experience, you know, where you're like, I'm just trying to find something that's going to make me feel good.
Yeah.
And then you try on stuff and nothing fits right. And it's like, it's just a slippery slope. If you're trying to actually treat your loneliness or your alienation or your feelings about your divorce or whatever it is with a trip to the mall, it's
a temporary fix. It's always because all those things, I would say other than connection, but all those things don't bring fulfillment. More clothes, more the quote unquote self-care, like, that will make you feel better for a moment, but it's similar to eating, you know, like, we'll eat a dessert to feel better, but then ultimately, or, you know, or go out and drink, but like, it will feel better for a second. It's just delaying you having to actually deal with the thing that you're avoiding. And again, I'm not knocking on people who have that as a solution for themselves, or maybe it's even just a sometimes thing, but when you have the ability to recognize that you're doing that for what your motive is when you choose to do something like that, it's so powerful, because you almost can realize how you've been deceiving yourself and then refuse to play that fucking game with yourself anymore. I have chosen to seek where is actual fulfillment in life. And it is in relationships, it's in people, it's doing good work in, like, in my career, it's being there for other people, it's not in material stuff, it's connection, it's enjoying a meal with a friend and having a good conversation, it's having experiences, traveling, enjoying, you know, music if that's what you're into, enjoying life. That's the stuff that you, like, at the end of your life, you're going to look back on and remember all of that. You're not going to remember, oh, I bought this thing that I loved. It's just that stuff is so, it's so just meaningless. And I often have this kind of morbid thought of, like, if everything went up in a fire, what would be the thing that I miss the most, you know? Or if I had to completely rebuild after a fire, you know, what would be the ways I rebuild? And that's kind of how you can identify what's actually important. I did have a long time ago, this was like 20 years ago, I was moving, and my ex decided we should put all of our stuff in a trailer like 2 days before moving. Someone stole the whole trailer. And I will still blame him on that. But my baby pictures were in that trailer. Like all of the stuff, you know, there were clothes, there were band t-shirts from the early aughts, which I'm pretty sad about still, but the baby pictures, you cannot get that back. So yeah, thinking about all of the stuff that was stolen, I probably wouldn't be sitting on that armchair anymore. I wouldn't be wearing those clothes anymore. But yeah, I do wish I had the stuff that was actually important.
Yeah. I had a profound experience like that when I was 10. Our house burnt down. Mm. And the only things that my mom and I really cared about were the photo albums.
Yeah.
Which got smoke and water damage, but they made it through. Mm. And for me, it was my stuffed animals, you know, because I was a kid and those were the things I cared about. And some of them could not make it through. And I really, and pets, of course. And that was just a huge loss. Yeah. But feeling like my stuffed animals didn't make it through the fire, like that was such a heartbreak for me because I had invested so much meaning in the comfort that they gave me, but nothing else mattered.
Yeah.
Nothing else.
Going back to when, you know, when I say I lost everything in Atlanta in my divorce, basically I didn't get the house, but I was awarded everything that was in the house. It's just like, where am I going to put all this stuff? So I immediately had to have an estate sale to sell everything that I couldn't fit into a tiny micro studio. Mm. So in a way, I lost everything. And it's similar to something like a fire where it's like, I don't have a choice in the matter. But that was so defining for me. I actually pulled this open. So it's in my book, but this is an illustration of, those are all the actual sofas.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
I still remember them and I had pictures, but I don't have any of this anymore except for one of those orange ones. All of that was stuff that I owned that's gone, and it's okay.
Yeah. And it's okay. It's okay. The stuff does not define us.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
So what are some suggestions for the audience about how to buy less?
Yeah, absolutely. I would suggest, and I know this is kind of scary, but I suggest doing something huge. Not just buy less, because that's the sort of thing that I did and it would last for a little while. It's just like when we say, I'm going to, you know, eat less donuts. I used to get a donut every weekend. And I'm like, I should do that less. But if it's too easy, it's just not going to have an enormous impact on your life. So I do recommend doing something, making a huge decision and going for a year. It's similar to also in rehab for addicts. Mm-hmm. Like you can go and get dry for a week, but if you go in to like an inpatient facility for 90 days, your success rate is going to skyrocket. So if you do something impactful and big, then you're much more likely to have it turn into a heart change. Mm. So I recommend doing something for a full year. Otherwise, it's not enough. And it doesn't have to be buy nothing. It could be something like, I'm not going to buy anything that's new.
Mm.
Or it could be, I'm not, it needs to fit with your values. So if, say, fast fashion, I'm not going to buy anything that's fast fashion, or I'm not going to buy any coats because I have enough coats. So that's when it's much more digestible. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to identify the areas where it wouldn't be that difficult, but it is still a commitment that you make for a full year.
Mm. I love that. I love that you're saying to people, don't do this incrementally. Like you will not have the big revelations if you do it incrementally.
It's like, I hate to break it to you, but you can't, you've got to do something huge. Otherwise, it's just too easy to fall back into our old ways.
Mm. I am a massive fan of big change. It's so hard in the beginning because you're totally on new legs, right? And you don't know whether they work or not, and you don't know what the rules are, and you don't know how to navigate it. You're very present to every moment of life because you are doing something so differently. I think that's part of something that's so magical in midlife when women decide, okay, actually, I'm going to do things differently, and I don't know how to do it, and I know it's going to be uncomfortable. And I know I know it's going to be challenging and make me feel weird and awkward. And I'll have to explain myself to other people, justify my decisions. Right. But what I found talking to people on this podcast is like, there's so much reward on the other side of doing things that are aligned with your values, aligned with your own integrity, and like connect you to yourself and your authentic, you know, way you want to be in the world. And look, this gave you a whole new path and a whole new conversation to have with people and a way to live your values really publicly that you didn't have before.
And I don't need to go around telling people that they should do what I'm doing, because so many people now come to me. They've seen what I've chosen to do for myself as an inspiration. And so it's a great jumping off point for me to make suggestions like that. Like, if you're not ready to do what I'm doing, there's so many things you can do that will move you in the direction of having a better relationship with material things. Some people do it for financial reasons as well.
Of course.
I didn't when I first started, because I was in a very secure job, but now I'm not. And so I've made adjustments over time. So I've now I'm not allowed to buy whatever food I want whenever I want, because I'm actually doing a food budget now. And so I have to, I'm allowing myself to eat out once a week. That's going to be my, for the year, I have to eat at home. Not my favorite, but it's helping me so much. And already I'm like, I've already saved thousands of dollars by not just eating out all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could do it with that intent, or that could be a byproduct of actually saving money in your bank account that wasn't going to be there otherwise.
Another tip is accountability. So when you decide what it is you are going to not buy, then tell your closest friends. Even just telling people, even if you don't say, hey, will you hold me accountable, which is also a good thing to do. But even if you don't do that, at least this is how it worked for me. I would have been so embarrassed if I went around telling people I'm not going to buy anything for a year and then they watched me buy stuff.
Right.
So.
Right. Yeah. Sort of telling on yourself and, and being accountable.
Exactly.
To that.
Although now I have to justify in a lot of ways, like people might look at me like, where'd you get that dress?
I got
it with a gift card. But yeah.
But yeah, usually people aren't thinking about you as much as you're thinking about you.
Absolutely.
So it's that's so a gift of life to when you realize that, like, mostly people are just thinking about themselves.
You're right.
One thing that you said is that like what this has given you is freedom from trends. Freedom from feeling like you have to follow what the consumer trends are, and you know, and really cultivating your own style that is aligned with your own values. And I just love that so much.
Yeah, I don't even know what the trends are.
it's like its own form of liberation.
Being in my 40s, I don't know that I could have kept up with it anyway. So it's so. It's such a relief to not have to play that game anymore.
Amen. Yeah. I love that. Liz, I have asked everyone who's come on the podcast one question, which is, are there any deal terms in your life that you want to renegotiate? I think we think we're fixed, like we are a fixed entity and all the deals we've made are written in stone. And I mean that like literally and figuratively from a deal perspective, but it's like, is there anything you clearly have been grappling with this particular zone for a long time and have made it a piece of your life's work?
Yeah.
Is there any other area where you want to rewrite the rules?
Ooh, what a great question. I think I'm just learning so much through practicing this for the last 4.5 years, how malleable our lives actually are. I think as a 20-year-old, I thought, this is just how I am. And I think many people move into the second half of their life and they still have that idea where it's like, this is how I am. I'm trapped here. Mm. I can't move out of it.
Yes.
And it's such a gift to have gone through the experience of losing everything and totally having to have this paradigm shift in everything in my life, especially as it relates to material things. But I think being open-minded to the ways that we might change throughout our lives, even we're not trapped in our personality. We're not trapped in, like, you know, some people think, oh, I'm a Virgo, therefore I'm this way. I don't think that. I do have, like,
I am a Virgo, and that is why I am that way. But
Or it's just an example. I know about my personality type, for example, and I think it's so useful to understand your personality, but then also just because you fit into that category doesn't mean you're trapped in it. You can actually overcome trauma, and that's been a big one for me. Like, I did have a lot of trauma, and then I have decided for myself, I don't want my identity to be a person who has experienced this thing and never overcome it.
Right.
So I've faced that scary stuff and decided I'm not going to let this rule my life. Mm. And I think it'd be a really great thing if everyone could get more comfortable with the realization that just because we are the way we are at this very moment, that doesn't mean we're going to be that way in 5 or 10 years. Mm. And we can design what we want our lives to look like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that so much. Thank you so much for this conversation, Liz. It's very inspiring.
Oh my gosh.
And it makes me think about, it's uncomfortable to think about sort of stepping out of consumer culture and not participating in that in the way that I always have. And you've given me personally a lot to talk about and a lot to talk about with my kids, which I'm really grateful for. So thank you. Thanks for coming on.
I just want you to know also, like, you're such an inspiration to me, and I've been listening to the podcast. And it's such a treat to be able to be here and to talk about this with you, especially knowing that you had no idea all of the different touch points where it makes sense for us to be having this conversation.
Yeah.
You thought it was just going to be about not buying stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, like everything, it's so much deeper than that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Liz. Thanks for listening to Hotter Than Ever. Have you been listening to our weekly advice episodes? We are always looking for more great questions from you, the loyal and devoted, or even first-time listening Hotter Than Ever audience. If you are a first-time listener, welcome. If you are a loyal listener, we love you already. Are there issues in your life you would like my very biased feedback on? Just DM us on Instagram at Hotter Than Ever Pod, or call and leave an old school voicemail, or text your question to the Hotter Than Ever Hottie Hotline at 844-2303. 323-844-2303. I would love to answer your question in a future episode. And if you leave a voicemail, we'll play your audio too. Hotter Than Ever is produced by Erica Gerard and Podkit Productions. Our associate producer is Melody Carey. Music is by Chris Keating, with vocals by Isa Fernandez. Come back next week for another totally unexpected interview or an advice episode that holds a grain of insight that you can take with you into your life. There may be more than one grain. That's what we're here for, ladies, to share the wisdom and to help set each other free from feeling like there's only one way to do things, only one way to live your life. Guess what? It's all totally made up. That is the good news and the bad news. I'm glad to be with you on this leg of the journey.